Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name's Josh Bannister and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Bentham, who are both pastors of Christ Church Hayward Heath. In this episode we discuss Love Thy Body, a Christian book which critiques a secular worldview which facilitates, excuses or even encourages certain actions or behaviour which the Bible seems to be against. So we talk about how our view of the body and of what constitutes a person might impact our views, particularly when it comes to things like sexual ethics and abortion. So let's get into it and I'll catch you again on the other side.
Hi, I'm Mark Bentham. I'm one of the pastors of Christchurch.
I'm Graham Nichols, also at Christchurch in Hayward Heath.
And I'm Josh Bannister, and you're listening to Ordinary. This week we're going to talk about a book called Love Thy Body by Nancy Pearson. But before we... Actually, it's Piercy.
Yeah, it's Nancy Piercy.
It's Nancy Piercy. But before we go on to talk... I have actually read it. You wouldn't think so, would you? No. Before we go on to talk about that, I want to ask Graham about a recent trip that you took to Uganda. And could you tell us a bit about why you went there and how it was for you?
Yeah, I went there because in God's amazing kind of pulling of things together, I met some bloke in a dinner queue in Scotland who happened to be from Uganda and wanted me to go to Uganda to connect up with some churches there. So out of a very tenuous connection, ended up over there preaching three sessions in a big interdenominational conference. About 5,000 people were there. And so that's kind of the why. And that's the other sort of part of the why, that was practically the why, was to see whether maybe it would be a useful strategic connection for the longer term. It was to try and bring a slightly different perspective, because it's a very Pentecostal, charismatic sort of scene there. You basically got the dead liberal churches, and then you've got Pentecostal, charismatic, the alive ones. There's not a lot in between. So it's to provide, a slightly different perspective in terms of what's good to preach and.
What do you mean by different perspective?
Because I'm not a Pentecostal charismatic, I guess, and my approach to preaching was different to most of the preachers there.
Good, you're going to have to describe.
Including the ones from England. So it's not like, this sounds a bit pompous, so I'm going to sound pompous for a moment, but I preached the Bible. In the sense of, here's some words from the Bible, here's what they mean, here's how to apply them. I think those guys tend to have good Bible knowledge, but they take a Bible idea, and so then they go for a text, and then they kind of work, not so much the text, and not even so much the idea, but they kind of use it as a springboard to talk about a few Bible-related ideas. But also, at the same time, they have a big emphasis on healing and deliverance and not prosperity in an absolute prosperity gospel sense, but kind of an expectation God's going to bless you materially and get you out of poverty. So it was. I'm a bit different to all that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it was hilarious.
So highlight of the trip and point of feeling most uncomfortable in the trip in a conference where you are so not like everyone else.
Do you know what? The things that might have been uncomfortable, because you're out in a big field, when this stuff that's going on that's probably more extreme than anything I've ever experienced in the UK, I was totally relaxed. So there were guys rolling on the floor, having something experience happening, and there were people coming forward, and there was a lot of loud shouting about, you know, being people being delivered and so forth. But I was totally chilled because everyone else was totally chilled around me. You know, there were those who were involved, and there were those who were just sitting around, drinking their water, going off to the loo, as though it was like a normal day. So that was not a low light, strangely enough. The low light was, we're driving down, it's my first day there, and there's these street sellers, when you stop in a town somewhere, there's these street sellers selling all kinds of stuff, like chicken on sticks, like that's just been cooked, you know. It's a kind of poison fest.
Okay.
But anyway...
Not yum.
People eat it and it's all, no, it smells quite nice, but I didn't want to risk it. Anyway, so they were selling also hot bananas in a little tray. So I was told strictly, don't eat any fruit that you can't peel yourself, and don't drink the water and so forth. So I thought, bananas, perfect. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, I'll have one of them because I was quite hungry. So I was given this banana, and then the guy said, oh, you eat the whole thing because it's warm and you just eat the whole
thing. You eat the peel as well.
Including the peel, because it's a particular banana that kind of works like that. So then I'm sitting there, and this is my driver, and I don't know him that well. So I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I can't be rude and throw it out the window, but I don't want to eat it because there's been all sort of hands on it, you know, and I don't know how hot it's been taken to. So then I started to try and peel it, but the skin had adhered to the banana.
Oh, nightmare.
So you're trying to peel it off, you know, like an orange that's gone wrong or something, where the peel and the pith and everything's all stuck. So I'm taking bits off.
I like the idea of an orange that's gone wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've got to interject at this point that to help people understand that there could be a tendency that you might be known as a little bit of a hypochondriac as well. Putting it out there that you're on that axis, aren't
well,
you?
Well, I'm quite a long way up that axis, yeah.
I was trying to be kind.
And so here's this banana, and I'm trying to, if you can kind of picture it, it's in my hand. There's a driver on my right. There's people behind me from various African countries. So I don't want to like make a faux pas on my first day, but I don't want to eat the banana skin. So I'm trying to peel it off with my thumb, and it's coming off in little bits about the size of a small coin, you know, little lumps. But and I've got a suit jacket on, sort of, because I thought I'd better take a suit jacket to look
and
kind
a Line of Judah
smart.
T-shirt.
I did have a Line of Judah t-shirt on that day.
I did see.
And so I'm getting the bits of peel and putting it in my suit pocket.
No!
Very discreetly. I think I'm going left pocket, because that's away from the driver, because they drive on the left. And
he's thinking, why is this guy putting
banana was in? The banana was beautiful. I think the highlight, in a funny sort of way, was something that I'd never do, which was do an appeal. So I preached on the third day, and preached from Revelation, talked about blessing and curses, and I'd finished. I prayed. I was about to get down from the stage, hand on my shoulder, me dad, the guy who's my host, who says, people need to come forward and respond to this. So I'm thinking, okay, that's not what I normally do, but that's fine. And we waited and waited, and then three people came forward. So it's a bit kind of awkward, you know, everyone else has had hundreds. And and there's three people, and they you know, they look a bit disinterested anyway.
It's a pity.
But he keeps going. And and then 200 come forward out of the group. And, you know, that was cool. And, you know, it's really hard to say whether it's people kind of repenting because they lack assurance or what. But I think they're genuine coming forward. They want to do something to, you know, with God. So then we prayed, and they prayed a kind of prayer of commitment and becoming Christian. So I don't know whether 200 people became Christians or what, but it was a great experience. But more than that, I kind of felt that it would be good to pray for Uganda and the whole situation then. And he called everyone out into this middle area. And so there were like 5,000 people kind of there with their hands in the air and me praying. And it was just very humbling. I prayed like I'd normally pray, but it was just quite moving and humbling. So that was a highlight. We need to talk about some other stuff. So thanks for
that's great. Good to hear
you can
about
edit that.
That
as much as you like.
Yeah, we'll cut all that. No, that's great. It's good to hear. We will talk about Love Thy Body. Do you want to give us a summary, either one of you, or just a quick summary of what the book's about? Before we get into some details and talk about some of the nitty-gritty.
It's a very stimulating book. You wouldn't agree with everything it says, and maybe it pushes it too far, but it tries to kind of examine a current way of thinking about the self as separate from the body and all the implications of that, the autonomous self, in other words, kind of ourselves being the governing thing, and actually the self needs to be satisfied, not the body. And it kind of creates, it suggests anyway, that our culture is creating a disconnect between the self and the body, which means the self can do what it likes with the body, and the body's just a kind of receptacle of that, and is almost arbitrary. And there's lots of implications. And before I read it, I kind of thought, does that really work in all these different contexts? But I think it mostly does, even though it might not be a perfect model. I think it's helpful.
And she's based it on Schaefer stuff, isn't she? Do you want to speak into that?
No, okay. You better.
Well, just in the sense of he has the upper and lower
scores of
the room, isn't it? So she then helpfully kind of puts that in the sense of the body is in the lower house, it's objective, it's valid, that kind of thing. And upstairs is the, your values. So this would be that the self is upstairs, that, and this is how they divide personhood theory as well, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And she keeps going back to lots of different models about an upstairs and a downstairs and kind of distinctions. The where you have to kind of navigate it quite carefully is because in Christian anthropology, what we think about what it is to be human, we do think about a body and a soul. So it's kind of, you have to work that then to say, well, how do we think about it? And it's very interesting because I'm also reading another book about the brain and whether the mind is distinct from the brain and so forth. So it kind of, that feeds into it as well. You know, what do we actually think as Christians? Sometimes you can have categories that are not really biblical. They're just, they've been culturally kind of absorbed about distinctions that are not necessarily there. So yeah,
I found helpful with that distinction in the book was that actually this kind of upstairs downstairs, in the sense of she talks about it in terms of originally, you know, shows it in different areas, but she talks about the concept of truth, and upstairs is kind of theology, morality, your private subjective relativistic kind of thinking or values. Then downstairs would be like the science, which is public, objective, value for everyone, facts. Yeah. So these are the facts, but actually those things are not, they can be, and that's where the body would fit in that downstairs area. Yeah. So it's interesting that although you can see that there is a factual of the body, actually what trumps everything now is what you think and your person self views of stuff is more important than actually even the actual objective facts, etc.
And here's where I think the contradiction comes out in the worldview, which she is criticizing, which is that she's laying out this idea that the presupposition of the kind of secular world is that your self is more important than your body, than the physical, right? But at the same time, the secular world wants to deny the idea that there is anything other than matter.
There's a
contradiction in there already.
Yeah.
And I think what's important to realise when you read this book is that she is talking about presuppositions that are most of the time unconsciously held by the general public. So these aren't ideas that people don't walk around saying, no, I'm pro this, I'm pro abortion, I'm pro this, I'm pro any of these things, with these ideas really fully formed in their minds. What she's saying, what she's drawing out, is what the unconscious, what the hidden ideas behind those things are.
Although it's interesting you say, because we were watching Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. little plug there, the other day, and interesting, one of the whole season is, without making a spoiler alert, is that actually this idea that actually the body is irrelevant, and actually all you need is the self. And so kind of Matrix, like this guy had invented this area where you're just attached into a machine and you're experiencing life in this kind of world called the knowledge that is out there, and you don't need your body. And then because it's been able to download your whole mind thinking, actually you can then be killed, but you still carry on existing in this kind of scientific knowledge world. But it's interesting that underneath it was, you know, these lines whereby, well, actually the body's irrelevant, you don't need the body, it's just your mind, it's just yourself, that's all that is, the body, who cares about the body? Although it is subconscious, actually it is out there, that they're kind of, that thinking is you know, making its way into the shows and that we're watching.
So could we explore some of the implications of that that kind of worldview, of that mind body split?
Yeah, I think it works its way in a number of ways. I think, just to pick up on your point, there's lots of things in cultural kind of thinking that are not necessarily deeply rooted. They're just kind of absorbed. I mean, to be fair, that happens in the church as well. Not everyone thinks through every single doctrine all the time. So there's a kind of, it's inevitable sometimes that there's just a kind of soup, the air we breathe. But I think that it's right to point out the contradiction and kind of just think about it a bit. Because people haven't thought through it, and maybe when they do, they might think slightly differently. But yeah, the where it comes out is that if the person, however we kind of root that, if the person is what's really important, then the body is either expendable or it's malleable. We can kind of twist it to use it sort of how we want. It gets, in a way, straightforward in terms of sexual ethics, because you could say, well, in myself, I want to behave sexually like this, or in myself, I want to behave in terms of this gender or that gender or some other gender, or no gender. And so then the self, if the self feels like that, then the body has to kind of tag along and kind of implement that. So the body doesn't have anything to say about that. It's as though the body doesn't have a view. So that kind of is where it plays out there. I think it gets a bit more complicated to do with things like abortion, for example, where she makes the application to abortion. And I get it. I think it's fair enough. But it then becomes the fact that the body as a kind of living organism doesn't matter. It doesn't exist. It's whether the self exists. So then you have to make some kind of arbitrary distinction to say, well, when does the self start being
this would
a
be
self with more
personhood
rights?
Theory, person, wouldn't it? This is the language that the word they wouldn't use self, it would use person, wouldn't it?
Sure.
Personhood.
Yeah, personhood theory. And then culture then has to decide, so when does this person have value and when do they stop having value, and make some, you know, discussion about that. Whereas I think it's much simpler for us as Christians to say when a body starts to exist, when a living organism starts to exist, that's when the person starts to exist. There's not something distinct. And so although we would say there's a soul that in some ways is separate from the body, it's so integrated with the body until we die and we're separated from the body, and then in the resurrection reunited with the body. But in terms of life, it's so integrated with the body, we don't make a separation in that sense and say, here's the soul playing out over here and here's the body here that is different. That's a very... as well, it's modern, it's a very ancient view, you know, that the kind of Greeks would have said soul good, body bad, which kind of allowed them to disparage the body, but also in a way do what they want with their bodies, because it didn't really matter, because it was this, you know, looking after the soul that's what really mattered. So yeah, it plays out in a lot of areas. I don't know if you want to talk about some others, but...
Well, I mean, I think in one sense... Abortion's quite on the agenda at the moment, isn't it? Especially with what's going on in the US and the Georgia debate, and the law that's saying that actually, you know, no abortion is now up to from 6 weeks on when the heartbeat comes. Yeah. But I think what struck me in reading the book is particularly was in the argument on abortion, particularly. I think you see how it strikes me how clearly this kind of works itself out in terms of the person. And I think it's quite an interesting area in that sense to see the definitions work itself out, which then become, I think, spill out into how science has lost the argument, actually, in the abortion argument because of this. Actually, they undermine themselves. And therefore, it just kind of fleshes things out. That then makes sense more in terms of euthanasia debate or the gender issues. So I wonder whether it is just worth just kind of fleshing that through a bit.
Spend a moment on that. Yeah, it's always really sad when you have to kind of research for doing anything like this, that you look at how many abortions, 194,668 abortions in 2017.
Is that UK?
Yeah, UK, sorry, thank you. And 9 million since the UK Act of 1967. So there's, I think this is correct, 1 every 3 minutes, 20 every hour, 600 every working day. And about 90% of abortions are for what's called social reasons. So although technically abortion is actually still illegal because of the Act, then it's possible to kind of get by that in some way. So there are provisions in the Act, but it's still in the Act, but it's still technically against the law. And I think the rationale for abortion has moved in that before the science was understood, it was more about kind of viability. So you'd say, well, when does the body become viable? Or it was more about when you kind of might recognise it as a person, when it was kind of big enough. But I think because the science has got much better and we understand that there's sensory kind of operation in the womb so they can feel pain, maybe even have, you know, some joy or depression or whatever, and start to kind of feel emotion in the womb as well, and have lots of cognitive functions, and survive from a much, much earlier age of development in the womb. That kind of argument has become less and less, because I think we are having abortions in this country, at least, where there's a possibility the baby could actually survive even from that point. In some cases. So then you have to kind of move the argument to say, well, it is a living organism. We can no longer deny that. And it is a living organism with kind of all the main features that an adult, not an adult, but a child, you know, viable human body would have. So we've got to put some other thing in there somewhere and talk about it as, well, it's not a person yet because it hasn't got a desire to live because it hasn't experienced life outside the body. So it doesn't know about that and it doesn't want that yet. So we'll just say that it's not really a person yet. So that means we can get rid of it. And that's particularly unreasonable in a way, because nobody even knows what desire an in-the-womb baby has, what sense of self, what anything they have. So it's just a way of kind of getting around it.
So what do you think fundamentally is driving that urge to say it's not a person?
I think because there has to be some non-scientific justification for abortion, because I think because the science had advanced to the point that we could get babies to survive from a much younger age, and because which is the strange irony you're talking about, the kind of human rights is a big deal. So I think people can sense the contradiction between human rights being a big thing and this autonomy of the self in general being a really good thing. It actually works really badly in abortion because you think, well, you know, what about the rights of the baby? So you've got to work around that, and you can't just say, well, the mother's rights trumps the baby's rights. The unborn baby's rights. You've got to then say the unborn baby doesn't have any rights yet because they don't quite exist yet in a way that we would recognise.
Which is a very metaphysical argument, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and I think, as you say, not, you know, people who are having abortions are not kind of walking around thinking this argument necessarily. You know, they're thinking this is completely culturally acceptable, and you know, this is what we do, and I'm in a situation where this is, you know, this is really not good for me, and so forth. So I don't think people are necessarily thinking it all through, but I think that's the underlying sort of arguments that are needed to kind of keep it going.
Well, I think that's been shown, isn't it, in the sense of in the US right now. So the argument has been come back that this is appalling for women's rights and their reproductive rights. That's the arguments put forward.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, where is the baby's rights? And the only way you can get around that, because as you said, you know, science has now, biologically they are human from this age, hence the George Laura, particularly the heartbeat argument, you then have to put in something else, which is a person. But then it gets even more confusing, because then it comes down to the woman's rights, because then they'll say, as long as the mother defines the baby as a person, it's a person. And US law, I believe, if a woman who is pregnant is shot and the baby is harmed or killed in that, as alongside the unborn baby and the mother, the person, the shooter, is prosecuted as two murders, which is completely, you know,
same stage in the pregnancy where the mother could go and legally get an abortion.
Absolutely. Yes. So you've suddenly got these contradictory laws, and what changes that is whether a person, the mother, defines the baby as a person or not a person. You go, well, something, so even that just logically doesn't start to weigh up, does it? Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's worth saying at this point, pastorally, you know, we in terms of caring for folks, you know, we recognize this is massive. You know, people who have had abortions, maybe and are now believers and caring for them, you know, and talking about forgiveness and restoration and hope in those things, and actually pastoring, caring for people. So we want to be sensitive to that, but at the same time, I think we've got to recognise the real wrestle that's going on in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely to that. And it's one thing to kind of understand what's going on in culture and society, but obviously for living through it, whether it's to do with having been involved in some way in an abortion or in some of the other kind of areas of sexual ethics, we want to understand in chatting about this kind of what's going on in culture. There's a whole different discussion to say, well, what if you've been involved in that? And there is forgiveness, and there is welcome, and there is care in churches and hope in the gospel.
That there's not being discussed in the culture when we talk about these things about person, is actually the mother may have this right according to the law, but actually no one's talking about actually what happens to the mother after.
Yeah.
Often for many of these poor women who have had abortions, actually they're struck with huge sense of guilt real, you know, hurt as a result. And so actually it's quite, you know, to be sensitive to that, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Could we spend a couple of minutes talking about what Nancy means by love thy body then? What is the biblical view of this kind of dualism of spirit and body, and how the Bible weighs the importance of both of those, and what the biblical approach is? What's Nancy saying in Love Thy Body to oppose these ideas?
Yeah, I think, amongst other things, she's saying that the body is something that is part of who we are. It's in the beginning, God created Adam and Eve as male and female with their distinctive body parts and with a physical material body that was essentially who they are, along with their spirit and their self, and that you can't sort of twist those apart, break those apart, consider them as something separate. So we would say, I suppose, in two ways, your body informs who you are. So if you are born male, that's a biological truth that the self has to affirm, that the soul has to affirm. So in a way, there's that way of traffic, of the body telling you who you are. But I think also, going in the other direction, what we do with our body matters, because it's not just an arbitrary set of biological material that we can do what we like with. What we do with our body in interaction with the world and with other bodies, other humans, made in the image of God, really matters. It's not just immaterial. It's not just irrelevant. It's not like just some random rocks colliding in space somewhere that has no meaning and significance. It's actually has moral significance, because God's placed moral significance in human beings, soul and body. So I think that's what she's saying, and we would definitely agree with that as being a Christian view of what the person is. And so we want to both be truthful about who we are as male or female, and indeed as children or adults, and as being humans, but we also want to take care of our bodies. We look after them when we go to Uganda and don't drink the water. We look after them in terms of what we actually do with them, both in terms of taking care, but also in terms of what we do morally with our bodies, because it matters.
And again, I think this is, again, just shows where the world argument plays down, because the whole time of trying to, that we recognize that our bodies are good, and we, you know, to show huge investment in looking after the body, looking good,
yeah,
all of that on one level. Even in the issue of sex, you know, recognizing the importance of sex in a relationship, but then saying actually the body doesn't matter when I just want to have casual sex, you know, to be able to try and it just shows the confusion, I think, of the world at this time, where you're trying to justify your decisions, and the way you're trying to do it is say the self is important, but at other points you're saying, well, no, the self and the body, we need both in certain circumstances. And I think just highlights just where confusion in the world is, and actually where the gospel then begins to say we have a voice, therefore, as believers, actually say, no, they matter all the time because of our relationship, who we are as created before, you know, a living God.
Yeah. I mean, there's quite a good section about the hookup culture, and I got to that chapter and I thought, there's no way she can kind of connect this thing with that, but she does quite well, I think, which is to say that if you have casual sex with someone, you're making promises with your body that your soul or your person can't keep, and is not keeping, and is not committing to keeping. So you're actually making a separation and saying that my body's doing something over here, but I'm not really into it. And I think it makes a good, it's a non-biblical argument in a way, but it's more of a kind of utilitarian argument to say it's a good thing, to say that marriage is really good because it's a coherent commitment of body and soul in relation to someone else. And it's only really in marriage that you're actually lining up your heart commitment with your body commitment to somebody. So I think that was really helpful, thinking about that. And actually, just case studies in there, or little kind of sound bites of people, kind of student age people, who are just really dissatisfied with the hookup culture, with sort of casual sex and kind of separating it. And I think there is a whole cultural shift going on. I was listening to something yesterday to do with alcohol. You know, that generally the millennials are drinking less than their parents were, drinking less alcohol than their parents were. And I think generally having sex less.
Yeah, that's true. Generation.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's all kinds of social reasons to do with that and to do with the kind of individualism and you know, being on your own more and on the internet and so on. So there's those kind of sociological reasons. But I think there are also reasons that there's a kind of recognition that this isn't really working, this whole kind of free love thing. It hasn't really been a very good project. And I think that's good. That's good opportunities for the gospel to say, not only in terms of sin and relationship with God, but actually with that comes a whole view of how life works best. But in both use of the my life, my body, everything kind of works under God. So I think we've got a great sort of argument to make in that.
So to finish off, read the book. Really helpful. In terms of working through lots of these issues. And I found it really helpful in just thinking through, oh, this is how the world thinks, which helps us in terms of engaging with the world as we seek to apply the gospel into their lives. And, you know, it's very readable. You know, we've read it as a staff team. We've recommended it a number of times to the front. We would highly recommend you go read this book. And then let us know what you think.
Thanks for joining us for another podcast. We've had lots of emails suggesting great topics for future podcasts. And if you'd like to suggest some yourself, then you can email us on ordinary@cchh.org.uk. Catch you next time.